Tate Chronicles now transmitting.
Welcome to the Tate Chronicles on Healthcare Now Radio. And now, here's your host, Jim Tate.
Good day, citizens of the free world, from border to border, coast to coast, and to all the ships at sea, I bring you a warm welcome. This is your correspondent, Jim Tate, and thank you for tuning in to the Tate Chronicles. Join me as we cut through the fog that exists at the leading edge of healthcare delivery and technology. I'm so pleased today. My guest is Amit Trivedi. Amit is the Director of Informatics and Health IT Standards at the Health Information and Management System Society, better known to us all as HIMSS. He's responsible for directing the ecosystem of health IT standards for HIMSS. He's been involved with health information technology for over 15 years, and we first met over 10 years ago due to his work with EHR testing and certification bodies. So, Amit, welcome to the Tate Chronicles.
Well, thank you, Jim. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here.
Let's take about 10 steps back before we get into the weeds here and talk about interoperability. Boy, there's so many layers of this. We've heard about it for years. It's always what's going to happen this year, next year. But my first question about interoperability, do we have the sufficient communication protocols and data standards? Have those been enacted and put down in concrete to lay a foundation for the exchange of clinical data going forward?
Well, it's a good question to start with. And so I'm going to reach back a bit and say, looking back at the last decade or so, and I think you were right there with me, there's been a lot of work on standards and interoperability, especially through some of the testing and certification programs that were run by the ONC. And so that's a lot of my experience from the past, as well as some of yours. And through that process, through the certification and testing of health IT for meaningful use, I think we got to see some of the good, the bad, the ugly. The good is, while it took us a while and a lot of stimulus money, I think we were able to lay the standards foundation that we have today, right? And so it wasn't pretty, it wasn't easy or cheap, but I do believe we have the infrastructure nationwide, and you see it through things like eHealth Exchange, Care Equality, Commonwealth, the different health information exchanges regionally that have built on this foundation of communication and content standards. And now, and of course, it's not enough, and we could do better, but we have that basic level of interoperability. Folks can go to their patient portal and pull up their last visit, see their labs. Electronic prescribing, even for controlled substances, is a thing now. There's all kinds of interoperability, yet, there's still so much more we can do. But in terms of having a foundation for exchange, I think we have that. But that said, we also have some changes abound, right? So on one hand, we have what some people are calling, classical interoperability, this foundation of exchange that really is what runs the health IT exchanges in our nation. But then there's also FHIR, fast healthcare interoperability resources. This is the hot thing in our field right now. And the promise around FHIR is unleashing that data through the use of APIs, being able to more easily access siloed data, connect legacy systems. And of course, this is all built using modern web-based technology, which sounds great, except for the folks who've, nearly killed themselves working and investing in the tech to get them where they are today. And so that's why, there are initiatives out there, like the one I'm working on with ONC through our group at IHE USA, to help build these types of glide paths to both preserve existing investments in health IT, yet help folks get on the FHIR information, superhighway. But as I talk about FHIR, or any standards or interoperability. You know, we still haven't found the silver bullet. There's no panacea, but FHIR is incredible in certain progress. And there's a reason why people are excited. Because, you know, in a way, I think FHIR is part of the concept or the movement to democratize standards. And, you know, I have a lot to say about that. But, you know, as an industry, I think one of the things we need to work on actively is making health IT easier, simpler, and more accessible. And that's one of the things that is the promise of FHIR. And I think part of the future to, you know, move us from where we are today to the interoperability that we want and need.
Well, since you brought up FHIR, let me address that. Over the last, I can't remember when CCHIT first did their certification standards, maybe 2005, 2006, something like that. And early on, there were attempts at interoperability between different systems using, I think initially, some version ones of CCDs or CCR files that had a certain structure. Would allow the exchange of information on a particular patient. And then we moved into CCDAs. And is the next step, FHIR, is that a evolutionary step or a revolutionary step towards the process of exchange of an acquisition of clinical data?
That's a great question. And hopefully we still have our listeners because I often lose people with my acronyms, starting with CCHIT and, you know, the Certification Commission, or also known as CSHIT, if I can say that, but a lot of people knew it as that. But that said, yeah, FHIR is, I think, revolutionary. And part of it is certain topics, ignite the passions in folks, right? Mm-hmm. And so one of the things around FHIR is being able to get at granular pieces of data, which can be a beautiful thing, depending on your perspective, right? If you're a health app, you don't need a huge CCDA document with all the patient's data and lots of extra stuff. Maybe you just want a lab result, a positive, a negative. But then if you're a provider, maybe you need that full, maybe you're used to and you want the full document. You want to see the history. You want the provenance. You need that, and it gives you the comfort to treat the patient the way you want to treat the patient. And so with, I think, any technology, and maybe the better the technology, sometimes the more controversial it can be. There's a lot around FHIR that we still need to figure out. And part of that is that whole document versus granular mm-hmm. data paradigm. There's a lot also around privacy and security, API access. So all in all, I think it is, you know, It's the evolution of standards, but it's going to be a revolution for the industry.
You know, part of this will be the adoption of FHIR. And usually the adoption takes place quickest when it's mandated. And so I believe for certified technology, the mandate for the FHIR standard is the end of December 2022. Is that correct? For certified
I
technology?
I believe so. Yeah. I believe so. Now, so I'm not running a test insert lab, so yeah. I started to pull back from some of the dates and things like that. But that said, yes, and you know, adoption's key. And then, you know, part of the adoption is who is required to adopt and what and when, right?
Yes.
And so I think we'll probably be talking about this later in terms of, you know, where there may be gaps or where do we see more and less adoption. And so with FHIR, it can potentially be easily adopted, but it depends on, you know, the setting and the technologies that we're talking about and the use cases.
Well, let me give a use case and maybe you can clarify how it might work. Let's say I've been discharged from the hospital and three months later, I go see my primary care physician and they want to get access, FHIR access to some of my hospital data. Would my primary physician initiate some type of FHIR request that would go through an API and pull granular data that they may want out of the hospital system?
So they may, but more likely today, they can probably access that data through carry quality, the services that certain vendors provide, pulling up. Actually, there'll be multiple different queries to multiple different places, from HIEs to eHealth Exchange Network, et cetera, Commonwealth. It may depend on the combination of, you know, what platform they're running and, you know, where they are as well. Because, you know, it's a world of haves and have-nots. So are we talking about, a large metropolitan area? Are we talking about, rural places? So there's disparities all about. And so in the situation you gave, it's more likely today that they're not doing a fire query yet. But I think in the future, we'll see, of course, much more of that.
Let me take a couple steps back and ask you about barriers to interoperability. Certainly, there have been technical barriers, and those continue. But to me, it's always seemed like there's some cultural barriers. I worked at a specialty pulmonary practice for a long time, and the only data that we pretty much trusted was our own data, because what we got from other providers, I mean, we trusted lab results, but what we got from other providers, we would want to rule it out also on our side. So some providers think, well, with interoperability, they're going to have a bunch of data come in and automatically become aggregated with their own data. And so there's, you know, certainly some cultural issues through that. And by culture, I just mean healthcare delivery culture in mm-hmm. North America. Do you see that has affected things very much, as opposed to maybe like Great Britain or Canada that has a national healthcare system where there probably are not too many private practices? They have that sense that it's their data and they own it on their patients.
Yeah, so there are absolutely cultural barriers. I always think of, you know, interoperability happens with the right combination of technologies, policies, and people, right? And so you can't eliminate the people part of it. And so culture is going to play a huge role in data sharing, right? And so you gave a couple examples of the idea of trust and ownership of data, right? So who owns the data? That's a big question. And you may get different answers depending on where you go. And you also brought up the case of, you know, the U.S. healthcare system versus what's happening internationally. And, you know, I have to say that my last decade plus, I've been, you know, neck deep in our national health system issues and, cultural technology policy, et cetera. But being part of HIMSS and now looking at more of the international level of what's going on, you know, no area is safe or, free from technology policy and cultural issues. But there's a lot we can learn, I think, from other areas as well. And so I don't know if we've quite solved that, right? There's going to be issues around trust, especially when data is coming in, you know, from other sources, patient-generated data. That's mm-hmm. a big question. And if people are wondering why would you trust that or why not, there's all kinds of factors. Like, so in the example of patient-generated data, you know, it's the fidelity of the data that may be in question, right? Was the data captured accurately? So is this something I want to treat the patient on? Then there's the question of, you know, we just talked about how your PCP may be pulling in data from all these different sources. So, you know, it comes down to provenance, timestamps, where did it come from? And how is it being aggregated? And so aggregating data, the reconciliation of data, these are not easy questions to answer, but we can and have figured them out in some instances.
The one thing that I've wondered about and would love your thoughts on, we're just over a year since the emergency declaration, National Health Declaration, emergency declaration because of the COVID pandemic. or just over a year when that was declared. Mm-hmm. And are there ways that the COVID-19 pandemic has caused some gaps in interoperability to be even more visible?
Well, you know, I think that's obvious that yes. And part of it is it's the pandemic, right? So anything that was broken or bad maybe just got worse. And so, you know, the one thing about the pandemic is it exposed so many different fault lines and issues, you know, whether it comes to, you know, whether we're talking about supply chains, care delivery, access, and then, of course, yes, interoperability. So what's the biggest example right there in front of us? You know, the public health system. I know you know all about meaningful use and certification and, you know, where the requirements were and who was responsible for them. Well, you know, public health systems were not really part of that picture, right? So we spent a lot of time on ensuring that there were end information, whether it was to, you know, quality registries, case reporting, we did it all, right, to send the data. But in terms of all the places that could receive the data, public health was definitely left out. And so I think we're feeling the brunt of that right now. And there's more. So if we're talking about gaps in interoperability, just recently, there was a high tech call, right? So the group of advisors that report back to the ONC, and we have a new ONC national coordinator, Mickey Tripathi. And he was laying out the ONC's and his administration's you know, priorities. And of course, COVID-19 response was number one. But as folks were going through and reporting on their various projects and some of the things that they were seeing, the conversation kept coming back to the various reported health disparities and the issues we're seeing across the nation in terms of care treatment and care delivery. And on that call, he coined a phrase that I think a number of us just latched onto. And he was like, you know, all of you guys, all of you folks should be thinking about in your programs, in your designs, about health equity by design. And I think this is an important concept, health equity. And it's something that's not really been part of the conversation when we talk about standards and interoperability. And this is one of the things where I kind of get excited about, because being, you know, at HIMSS, at a nonprofit, you know, mission-driven organization, health equity and diversity are part of our core values that we want to inject in the things that we do. And so now I get to bring that to some of our standards work. And if we talk about cultural barriers, you know, have you popped into any standards group lately? You'll see what I'm talking about. But, you know, we need more voices. We need, you know, there's health equity and health disparities happen because we don't get the right voices at the table. And, you know, I'm biased, but I feel like standards is kind of where a lot of this stuff starts. And, you know, having the right voices at the table from the beginning will help us ensure that down the line that things work out better. Because you know, when we don't have the folks represented, that's when we start to see disparities or biases in care plans, in the technologies that we deploy, in the implementations and the workflows, and then eventually the outcomes. And as much as we want to talk about technology or interoperability, it's really about health outcomes. And that's there's it's plain to see that it's a world of haves and have nots. And I think the pandemic also exposed that the have nots, it's just as important to care for those, for everybody, because whether a child is struck ill in your hometown or across the globe, and it's potentially a novel virus, does that affect you? Is that going to impact your day-to-day life? If you look left, look right, around, yes, it may be the difference between going back to school, seeing your family, you know, all kinds of things. And so I know this is way up there, but at the same time, I think, you know, I like the idea of health equity by design, and you know, we're going to take that to heart in our standards activities as well.
One of the, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, is I'd like to ask you about the process of interoperability, because in healthcare, new types of data arise, and I'm thinking around precision medicine and genomic research, things like that. And so obviously, at some point down the road, even in primary care, EHRs, there's going to be a need for some type of data format or access to data that has genomic access to genomic profiles and DNA information. In things like that, are there standards yet, or are the standards being worked on for precision medicine? That type of data?
There are. And I think there's, and again, when we're talking about things like, well, one, I wanted to say, I don't want to talk too much about genomics and genetic data. My wife is a genetic counselor by training, but she's the expert in that area. And I know I'm going to say something that might not be correct. And so I can tee her up for a future podcast if you need to. She'll probably be a much better interview too. But that said, you know, when we're talking about precision medicine, we're also talking about things like artificial intelligence, machine learning, and the data sets that we feed into, you know, these activities. And we know, we've read about the bias in some of these technologies that comes, you know, and accidentally, because the best patient data sets aren't out there, right? And so then we see that bias, whether it comes in voice recognition, facial recognition, et cetera. And then again, if we're not using a diverse set of patient data, this is going to affect health outcomes again. And so once again, we come back to health equity, the voices at the table, who's involved and who's not involved. And so, you know, going back to AI and machine learning, that all relies on aggregating a huge amount of data and large data sets. And, you know, if we really want to realize the power of AI, and we need better data to feed them in to start with.
I can't believe how time has flown. We only have about 3 or 4 more minutes, so I want to touch base on 2 other things, if you don't mind. One is, I believe you were involved with the IHE Connectathon last week. What was that all about, and what happened there?
Well, yes, we just had that last week. It was the IHE North American Connectathon. My team at HIMSS gets to run that. And it's basically one of the largest interoperability testing events out there, where we're basically taking the standards, the profiles that have been developed, they've been productized into systems. So we're not talking about hackathons, but we're talking about folks who've implemented these standards and profiles, and they now have the opportunity to validate their implementations and test against each other. And so for over 20 years, you know, the Connectathon has been running, started out in, you know, the garage of the parking garage of the RSNA, moved off to the ballroom floor in Chicago at a hotel I won't name, and then moved to Cleveland. And then, of course, last year we were lucky enough to have our event, but shortly after pandemic, and, you know, everything ground to a halt. But it gave us a year to plan a virtual Connectathon, which was not without its challenges. You know, taking an event where the beauty of it was you bring a couple hundred engineers together from competing or complementary companies that get to have that safe space to practice, to fail, to test and succeed, you know, collaborate, and then moving that all to virtual. We all know that it's difficult to, you know, to take face to face and make it virtual. But we were able to do that. We were able to use that event to bring in new and different people. This year, our plan was actually to be in Atlanta, to be closer to the CDC and really have a public health facing event. But once we had to go virtual, we still kept the goal to focus on public health and global health. But we also were able to bring in a host of folks who may not have been able to participate otherwise. And we also expanded some of the conference programming. But like the thing I was most excited about is a new piece that we added to the event, which are called standards acceleration tracks. And you might be chuckling because standards accelerate, it seems like the two words don't fit together. But, through the course of working in this area for so long, you get to figure out where the bottlenecks are, where the barriers are, and you try to break those down. And so one of the things we were trying to do was build that bridge between hackathons to more formalized testing events. And so we created three tracks, one focused on global health, another focused on local health, and on personal health. So the global health track really focused on basically, we had the support of communities from OpenHIE and OpenMRS and a ton of folks who were operating in low middle income countries and in different environments, not the US, not where we're used to, but folks who have been on the ground implementing Firebase solutions in countries like Tanzania, Malawi, Kenya, Nairobi, Haiti. And let me tell you, this was pretty new. Through HIMSS and through other venues, IHE USA, we were able to subsidize the participation for a host of folks that would have normally not been there. And so I've talked about how we need more voices at the table. Well, this was just a small step and a first step, but for the first time, we had more voices at the table, and it was a great learning opportunity, and the energy was palpable, but it's still not enough, and there's more we're going to do. And the focus of that particular track was using this open source tech stack to look at things like the International Patient Summary and using that as a basis to register a patient for COVID treatment, record vaccination information, and basically show that we can use these open source technologies, that these communities are in full support of it, and that we can use, we can put together a fire-based exchange solution using standards like the International Patient Summary. We did the same thing or a similar thing with local health, focusing in on a number of key public health projects like the CDC's MedMorph project and the SANER pilot and project, which is both are involved or related to pulling information for public health reporting and research. And then finally, we had the personal health track, which was focused on emerging technologies to support remote patient monitoring and personal health devices, which again is another area that's just exploding and ripe for innovation and disruption. And so there we had the opportunity to work with the IHE Devices Group, discuss things like open source software modules like Code for Health, and then really we found that there was a great overlap between all three tracks in terms of, certain solutions, certain discussions that needed to happen around implementing FHIR, developing standards, implementation guides and profiles, and also figuring out how to better support the testing of these things. Because it all comes down to eventually a lack of resources, whether it's financial, people, just inertia or energy. And I feel the more we can coordinate and align in certain areas, we'll be able to accelerate and move faster. It's the concept of doing more together instead of having all these little pockets of folks working off on their own. And I think that's probably comes down to, you know, a function of being at HIMSS and, you know, wanting to and needing to convene the stakeholders to get to action.
Well, thanks for that update. And, you know, it's a great segue. You mentioned HIMSS, and I'm looking forward to HIMSS 21 this year, August 9th through 13th in Las Vegas. And hopefully everybody will have had their one or two shots and we'll have a good, robust global conference this year. I'm looking forward to it.
So am I. And I was going to say, we weren't able to catch up last year, so I'm looking forward to it this year.
I am too. I'm already have my reservations in place. To our audience, thanks for joining us on this episode of the Tate Chronicles. I offer a special salute to my guest today, Amit Trivedi. Amit, thanks for coming aboard today.
Hey, it's been my pleasure, and hope we can do it again sometime.
I look forward to it also. You can find more information on this show's program page at healthcarenowradio.com. Until we meet again, here's wishing you smooth sailing and safe harbors.
Tate Chronicles transmission ending now.